Hi everyone, my name is Sebastian. Today we'll be discussing about an introduction to nanoparticles and nanostructures. So here's a brief outline of the topics we'll be covering. We'll start off with the definition and examples. Then we'll go into physical properties such as size, crystal structure, melting point, and mechanical strength. We'll discuss a few optical properties including surface plasmons and also quantum confinement effects. We'll end with a little bit of electrical property discussion, and also health concerns. So, what is a nanoparticle? There are various definitions you might come across. One of them will say is a structure with at least one dimension less than 1 micron. Here are a bunch of examples. There are sphere-like particles, such as silver nanoparticles or buckyballs. They could be rod-like particles, such as silicon or nickel nanowires. And they could even be tube-like particles, such as carbon nanotubes or titanium dioxide nanotubes. And we see a couple of images of these various examples over on the right. So, size is a material property. What do we mean by that? Well, on the left we have a brick of gold, and this is the gold that we're familiar with. We know it's kind of gold-colored, shiny, has some luster. We know its density and kind of its electrical conductivity, but these are all things we know about gold in the bulk form. And in the bulk form, the material properties don't change with size, so the resistivity, conductivity, melting point, and optical absorption doesn't change. But if you look over on the right, now we see the gold we're discovering. We see a bunch of vials with different colored solutions in them. Well, within these vials it's mostly water, and then there's a colloidal dispersion of gold nanoparticles. And because they're different size, okay, different diameter nanoparticles have different optical properties, and therefore we see these different colors. So it's not only the optical properties that change depending on the size of these nanoparticles, it's the material properties. So that they all change with the size of the gold nanoparticles. So this means the resistivity, the melting point, the absorption and transmission properties, all the properties change once you get down to this nano level. So how do you get there? Well, just for a thought experiment, if we took this brick of gold and cut it in half, we'd still be in the bulk form. We'd have two half bricks of gold, and they'd have the exact same properties. If you cut them in half again, you still have bulk gold. Well, if you kept cutting it down, you'd have gold for a long time, right? It would still behave as elemental gold. But if you got that chunk down to a certain size, if you could simply by cutting or breaking it, and you got down significantly below a micron, let's say around 300, 200, even down to 100 nanometers, you'd have a little ball, a little sphere of, let's say 100,000 or more gold atoms, and it would be small enough that we would see these unique properties start to emerge. Okay, so what are some of these physical properties? Size, we mentioned a little bit. We'll go into crystal structure, melting point, and mechanical strength. So why do we have, first of all, these unique characteristics of nanoparticles? Well, they have a large surface-to-volume ratio. There's a very high percentage of atoms or molecules on the surface. It turns out the surface forces are very important while the bulk forces are not as important. So this is true for any very small material. As something gets smaller, the surface-to-volume ratio increases dramatically. Metal nanoparticles, in fact, have unique light scattering properties and exhibit something called plasmon resonance. We'll talk about this in more detail later, but that's what's going on when on the previous slide where we saw the different colored solutions. Semiconductor nanoparticles may exhibit confined energy states in their electronic band structure. These are often referred to as quantum dots. We'll talk more about these later as well. So they also will show different absorption properties, but for a totally different reason. It doesn't have to do with light scattering, but it has to do with confined energy states. They can also have unique chemical and physical properties beyond what we will discuss, and what's interesting about nanoparticles is we're down at the same size scale as many biological structures. So this becomes pretty important when thinking about how these may interact with, obviously, our bodies and other biological structures. So here are some examples of unusual properties of nanoparticles. They have lowered phase transition temperatures. They have increased mechanical strengths. They have unique optical properties. They have altered electrical conductivities. They have altered magnetic properties. And they are able to undergo self-purification and self-perfection. So kind of by seeking certain energy states, they kind of tend towards symmetry. The physical properties of nanoparticles are dependent upon the size, as we already saw, but also the shape. Whether they're spheres, rods, or platelets, etc., can have an effect on their large-scale properties. Their composition, their crystal structure, for example, if they're face-centered cubic or body-centered cubic, etc. Surface ligands or capping agents can also play a role on how they can interact with their outside environment and therefore their physical properties. And also the medium in which they're dispersed will have an effect. So molecules, nanoparticles, and bulk materials can all be distinguished by an approximate number of atoms that make up each of these materials. So these are very approximate numbers, but if we look over on the right, we see if you have 10 to the 6th or a million or more atoms, okay, grouped together, at that level and above, we're considering it bulk material, okay? You see nanoparticles kind of has a wide range from 100 all the way up to 100,000 atoms. We're considering those nanoparticles. And then fewer atoms, 1 to about 10, were considered molecules. And of course, we know there are much larger molecules which have far more than 10 atoms. But this is just to give us an approximate range here, magnitude of order. So nanoparticles exhibit unique properties due to their high surface area to volume ratio. A spherical particle has a diameter D of 100 nanometers. So here we're just running through a quick calculation to find the volume and surface area. So when we plug in the numbers for 100 nanometers, which is 100 times 10 to the negative 9 meters, we see that the volume of that nanoparticle would be about 5 times 10 to the negative 22 meters cubed. And the surface area would be about 3 times 10 to the negative 14 meters squared. So a surface to volume ratio, we'd have a difference of 10 to the 8th. Okay, so the ratio would be greater than 100 million. So surface area to volume ratio. Why is this so important? Well, it gives us an approximate surface area to volume ratio of greater than 10 to the 7th to 1, and we just found something around 10 to the 8th in our last example. This is significantly larger than a macro-sized particle. As the surface area to volume ratio increases, so does the percent of atoms which are interacting with the surface. So surface forces become more dominant. This makes sense. If you think about a sphere made up of billion atoms, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of them on the outside, but most of them will be on the interior. If you tried to make a sphere as best you could out of 8 atoms, how many of them would be on the outside versus the inside? In that case, maybe all of them would be surface, okay? And, you know, our nanoparticles have more than 8 atoms in them, but the number is relatively small, so we have a lot of atoms on the surface rather than inside. Whereas bulk would have the opposite arrangement. Generally accepted material properties are derived from the bulk. This is when we typically think of an element. So when someone says copper, you think of that certain orangish metallic element which has certain conductivity and ductility properties. But those properties again would change for copper as well. Copper would behave as a metallic nanoparticle and exhibit plasmon resonance, just as gold does. So these properties will change at the nanoscale. Here's another slide. This is just showing a few calculations for volume and surface area of nanoparticles. These calculations are using nanometers as a unit of length. But just as a general trend here, on the far left, we see nanoparticle diameter. So as we go down, it's obviously getting larger and larger. So let's look at what's happening to the volume. Well, indeed, the volume is getting larger and larger. The surface area is also getting larger and larger. However, the surface area to volume ratio is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So, as the particle gets larger, the surface area to volume ratio gets smaller, and eventually you're at the bulk scale down towards the bottom when we're above 10 to the 6 atoms in the particle. And then we basically no longer would call it a nanoparticle. Here's a quick graph just showing surface area to volume ratio. And again, the ratio is high at small diameters, and you can see it's kind of exponentially decaying there at larger diameters. So just different ways to talk about the same concept. We threw out a couple definitions and examples. We did some calculations. We looked at some numbers, and now here's a graphical representation of that same data. So as the percentage of atoms at the surface increase, all the properties change: mechanical, optical, electrical, chemical, and magnetic. For example, the color of gold and silver nanoparticles will change when the dimensions are reduced and or the concentration of, say, surface atoms are changing. So down below, we see different colors, which are representing what colors these metal nanoparticles would appear to be in, let's say, a colloidal suspension. And then below that, we see we've got silver and gold spheres of various sizes, and then pictures of them taken with a scanning electron microscope. And actually, on the bottom left, we see silver nano prisms around 100 nanometer in size. Just on that last slide, real quick, we were seeing that you can obviously change the size of, say, a gold nanoparticle and get a different colors from the spectrum, but you can also get other colors by using other metals. So it depends on the characteristic element and on the size of the particle. Here is a graph showing what happens to the melting point as particle sizes change. So the overall trend is that nanoparticles have a significantly lower melting point than their bulk counterparts. We look up to the right, we're looking at the bulk melting temperatures, and we're up at, 1300, 1200 Kelvin. And as our particles get smaller and smaller and smaller, as we're seeing graphed towards the left, the melting point starts to decrease rapidly. So melting point versus shape, well, different things can happen depending on the shapes of the particles. So they may sinter together at lower than expected temperatures. Rods can melt and form spherical droplets if heated too high. And thin films can actually form pinholes, after which continued heating would lead to de-wetting behavior and even island growth or island formation. So these are different things we can see with these different types of nanoparticles or materials with a certain nano dimension. As far as crystal structure goes, we can say that most solids are in fact crystalline, with their atoms arranged in a highly ordered kind of 3D geometric repeating pattern. And this arrangement of atoms impacts the functionality of the material. So some solids have this order presented over a long range order, such as a crystal. Other materials are amorphous, like glass or wax, and they lack long-range order, but they can have limited short-range order. These are defined as the local environment that each atom experiences. That's what we mean by short-range. So you can have small regions of order, and then a grain boundary, another area of order, but when looked at kind of in a more holistic view, you would see that it was a disorder. The spatial arrangement of atoms in a crystal lattice is described by its unit cell. The unit cell is the smallest possible volume that displays the full symmetry of the crystal. And many materials have a preferred unit cell. So this is kind of the geometrical spacing between atoms in all three dimensions in a crystal structure. You can think of this as the favorite crystal lattice size and orientation when a particular substance forms a crystal. So in three dimensions, unit cells are defined by three lattice constants and three angles. When you put all these together, this will lead to 14 Bravais lattices, 14 possible Bravais lattices, each having characteristic restrictions on the lattice constants, angles, and centering of atoms in the unit cell. So the lattice constants basically make up the something like the distances between nearest neighbors in the X, Y, and Z planes. For cubic unit cells, kind of the simplest ones to understand and good for an introduction to crystal structure, there are three centering types. The simplest one is a simple cubic over on the left, and this just has an atom at all four corners of a cube you could envision. The body-centered cubic, or BCC, crystal structure, has an atom at all eight corners of a cube, but then also has one atom in the center of the cube, so it's called body-centered. Then the face-centered cubic, FCC structure, has atoms at all the corners of the cube, then it also has six more atoms, which are located in the center of each face of that cube. And notice there's no atom in the center of the body. So we have SC, BCC, and FCC as the crystal structures for the simplest cubic unit cells. As far as size and crystal structure, most metals in the solid form form close-packed lattices. For example, silver, aluminum, copper, cobalt, lead, platinum, and rubidium are all face-centered cubic. Magnesium, Nd, Os, Re, Ru, yttrium, and zinc are hexagonal close-packed, or HCP. Chromium, lithium, strontium, it turns out, can form body-centered cubic as well as face-centered cubic and hexagonal close-packed, depending upon the formation energy involved in that lattice formation. So how does crystal structure impact nanoparticles? Well, each material is going to pack differently. So nanoparticles, as a result, have a structural magic number. That is an optimum number of atoms that will lead to a stable configuration while maintaining a specific structure. The structural magic number, as it's called, will be equal to the minimum volume and maximum density configuration. If the crystal structure is known, then a number of atoms per particle can be calculated. So what is this? What's magical? Why is this a structural magic number? It turns out there are only certain numbers of atoms for a given element which will form kind of a symmetric, energetically stable nanoparticle. And it really has to do with, Gibbs free energy and achieving that lowest energy state. I like to joke that, the particles, everything wants to find its happy place. So that's what's happening. If a particle can form a structure so that it has its lowest energy state, the optimum number of atoms, okay, and a stable configuration, then that's what will occur. And this leads to several structural magic numbers for any given element or substance. So here's an example of close-packed magic number clusters. You can see they look fairly symmetric, not quite spherical, but there's definitely different planes of symmetry. And they can be thought of as being made by successively packing layers around each other, and there would be a single central atom in the center. Okay. And again, they're usually going for the maximum number of nearest neighbors, so highest density packing. And then also, you can think of them as trying to keep a low percentage of surface atoms as the clusters grow, as more layers are formed on the outside. Here's a little equation for n layers, the number of atoms, capital N, in an approximately spherical face-centered cubic nanoparticle can be given by the following equation. And here we just have a little polynomial equation here. And the number of atoms, therefore, on the surface can be calculated with this second equation. Again, N equals the number of layers in that nanoparticle. A little bit more on size and crystal structure. We have a couple calculations here. We're looking at the shell number, and the shell is basically like the layer. The table also shows diameters, total on the surface, and then the percent on the surface. So you can see as we get up to 100 shells, the percent surface is only 3. When you're down to one shell, you just have one atom, so obviously you're 100% surface. And that makes sense since we already talked about how when particles get smaller, the surface area to volume ratio starts to dramatically increase. In the bottom right, where it says other approximate values, it's kind of worth taking a look at. We're saying, let's say you're looking under a scanning electron microscope and you see a nanoparticle, it's about 20 nanometers in diameter, it would have approximately 137,000 atoms. If it were 30 nanometers, it would have about 482,000. And then 50 nanometers, 2.2 million atoms. So those are kind of nice approximations to be aware of. Wolf crystal shape. So, Wolf crystals are used to determine the shape of a crystal when formed under thermodynamic equilibrium conditions. The surfaces, as we've seen, are areas of high energy. And we'll see that different facets can have different surface energies due to their shapes. And the objective is to minimize the total surface energy of the crystal. So let's take a look at this in a little bit more detail. These plots will represent a simplified view of crystal faces. So instead of dealing with three dimensions, as you may in Miller indices and such, we're looking at a two-dimensional representation where the plane or the face crosses the X and Y axis. So these are Wolf crystal shapes. So if we look at the blue square on the left, basically we're ignoring the Z axis. So maybe it's coming straight at us, but we're not considering it right now. But we look at the Y and the X, and we see a face on top. That's a face, or think about that as one of the sides of a cube. And we're calling that face 0, 1. Okay, and the reason it's called parentheses 0, 1 parentheses is we're defining that face by where it crosses the planes. So it never crosses the X plane. So it would actually be infinity at X, and then it crosses the Y plane at 1. If you take the inverse of those numbers, 1 over infinity is basically 0, and then 1 over 1 is 1. So we write face 0, 1. Below, we see that there are a family of crystal faces, which would include all the following. We look over on the right, and we look at that bolded red face, and we think about, okay, where does that cross the x-axis? Well, it crosses it at the point 1 on the x line there. And where does it cross the y? It crosses at y equals 1. And 1 over 1 is 1. So face 1, 1 is what we would write. In parentheses, to represent that bolded red face there. Again, there are a family of crystal faces, and this can be represented by just writing the number, so 1, 1, within brackets instead of within parentheses. So, more on Wolf crystal shapes. Here's some Wolf plots. For these plots, the length of the arrow is proportional to the surface energy of that face, and longer arrows actually denote higher energy surfaces. So if you're familiar with vectors and vector arrows, basically they show a magnitude and direction, and we can use the length of the arrow to represent the magnitude, and that's what's going on here. In this case, it represents longer arrows represent a larger magnitude and energy. So we see increasing energy for longer arrows. So if you look down at the bottom, where we see various crystal shapes, and we draw an outline of the innermost facets to determine the shape of the crystal. The result will show that the high-energy faces expose less surface area to the external environment. So how can you tell, again, that they're higher energy? Because if you draw an arrow from the center to that face, that arrow would be longer and therefore have a higher energy magnitude. Deviations from ideal crystals. Well, often nanoparticles or nanocrystals do not form well-defined crystal facets. The wolf crystal shapes are idealized, and they're idealized because there are cases where the crystal surface energies determine the shape. So this is perfectly under a thermodynamic control. This is like an ideal, perfect world type situation. However, kinetic factors also often play a major role in crystal growth. And this explains why different processing conditions and techniques can lead to different morphologies for a given material. A roughening temperature also can play a key role. Above this temperature, surface atoms on a growing crystal have increased mobility. A liquid-like structure and well-defined facets do not form. Also, at elevated temperatures, all faces tend to have similar energy. For example, on macro scale, consider the CZ process for silicon. As far as altered lattice constants, we could compare lattice structure of a nano and bulk material. We would see shortening of bonds near the surface and surface reconstruction. On the bottom left, we see an example of an original structure. In the middle, we see shortening of surface bonds, which occurs, and also an example of what shifted surface bonds might look like. Okay, so next up on our outline is optical properties, and we'll talk about surface plasmons as well as quantum confinement. So optical properties, this is the size dependence on the optical properties of nanoparticles. And this is what we're concerned with. And it turns out it's a direct result of two distinct phenomena. One will be surface plasmon resonance, and this will occur for metal nanoparticles. And the other will be increased energy level spacing due to confinement of delocalized energy states. This is often called quantum confinement, and this is most prominent in semiconductors. So, for now, as an introduction, it's perfectly reasonable to think about surface plasmon resonance occurring for metal nanoparticles, and then quantum confinement occurring in semiconductor nanoparticles, which are also often referred to as quantum dots. So let's talk first about surface plasmons or surface plasmon resonance. So first of all, we should remember that metals can be modeled as an arrangement of positive ions surrounded by a sea of freely floating electrons. And the sea of electrons will behave like a fluid and can move under the influence of an electric field. So, over on the left, we see our, let's imagine a crystal lattice, where we have billions and billions and billions of positively charged metal ions. Let's say it's gold, so those are all gold ions in a crystal lattice structure, with electrons kind of freely floating around. On the right, you see we have an electric field applied from the top down, and the electrons will begin to move just like a fluid under the influence of that field, and they'll start to move upward towards the field since they're negatively charged. So, this is the reason we use kind of bulk metals like wires in our homes and different electrical appliances. This is why we use metals to conduct electricity where we want it to go. We do that by kind of applying a potential difference or voltage. And this gives us our electric field and that electron flow. So what does this have to do with optical properties of metallic nanoparticles? Well, think about now not a long wire, okay, or a large bulk metal, but think about a tiny gold nanoparticle. So it's a metal, but it's not bulk anymore. It's on the nano level. Well, it turns out if we have an oscillating electric field, and where could we find an oscillating electric field? Well, a photon is a great example. It's an oscillating electromagnetic field. So it's got an electric oscillating field and a magnetic field which oscillates. So remember, a photon, as everything else, has a particle wave duality. So we're imagining it's behaving as a wave in this case. And that oscillating electric field is going to cause the sea of electrons within that gold nanoparticle to oscillate as well. And these oscillations are quantized, and this has to do with some quantum mechanics effects, and therefore resonate at a specific frequency. So these oscillations are what are referred to as plasmons. Okay, and on a surface, this is referred to as surface plasmon resonance. So on the left, we see resonance at a metal surface. On the right, we see resonance in a metal nanoparticle. And this is the effect which is occurring in metallic nanoparticles, which changes the optical properties of that particle. Now you can imagine, if the particle is a different size, that means it has a different number of positive ions in it, therefore maybe a different size kind of electron, oscillating electron cloud, and finally that causes the characteristic optical properties to change as well. So the formal definition of surface plasmons is the coherent excitation of free electrons in a metal. The plasmon resonance frequency will depend on the particle size, but also its shape, and as we said, its material makeup. It's related to the plasmon energy by Planck's constant, E equals Planck's constant times frequency. Surface plasmons are confined to the surface of the material, and the optical properties of metal nanoparticles are dominated by the interaction of surface plasmons with incident photons. More on surface plasmons. Metal nanoparticles like gold and silver have plasmon frequencies in the visible range. Okay, so this is why we're able to see the colors. Okay, they seem to be being produced by these effects. This is why when you put gold nanoparticles in a solution, you can see colors in the visible range. When white light impinges on these particles, the wavelength corresponding to the plasmon frequency is absorbed. The spectral location, strengths, and number of plasmon resonances for a given particle depend on the particle's shape and size. So, here's another. We're familiar with the picture on the right, and over on the left we see an absorption spectra for gold nanoparticles. So this is 20 nanometer and 80 nanometer gold nanoparticles embedded in a glass. Light was shown through, and then certain wavelengths were absorbed and certain others were transmitted. So we can see the 80 nanometer particles had a absorption peak, and it looks to be about maybe 570, 580, while the 20 nanometer had an absorption peak at around 530. So the smaller one was redshifted, had a higher energy absorption peak. Surface plasmon shape, as we said, also changes the absorption. So we can say that they are shape dependent. For example, if you look on the right, we're seeing different colored arrows which indicate the illumination angle. So depending on how we illuminate a certain nanoparticle, assuming it's non-spherical, the different colors correspond to different plot lines. This occurs because the amount of light that's scattered into the far field is described by the scattering cross-section. And if you plot this against the wavelength of light which is used to illuminate a particle from a specific angle, that's what we see over on the right. So this graph is a little bit complex, complicated, but we're just showing kind of evidence that surface plasmas change depending on not only the size, not only the element makeup, you know, is it gold or is it copper, but also the shape. And why does the shape play a role? It has to do with the illumination angle on that particle. Here's another one where surface plasmons are shape dependent, and that dependency is upon the absorption spectra. So what we see is triangular shaped nanoparticles produce plasmons with altered frequency and magnitude. So depending on the shape, and assuming these are all about the same size and made up of the same material, they have different scattering cross sections, and therefore we'll see different absorbance spectrums. And that looks like different colors qualitatively. So now we need to think of, so we talked about metals and whatnot, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but we're going to start to go into what happens with semiconductor materials. How do their optical properties arise on the nano level? Well, we need to think about energy levels, and first we'll think about bulk materials, and then we'll think about kind of nanomaterials. So first, let's talk about a few things. One is the Pauli exclusion principle. And this states that electrons can only exist in unique, discrete energy states. What the Pauli exclusion principle really says is that no two electrons in one atom can have the same four quantum numbers. So what does that mean? Well, it means they can have the same three of those four quantum numbers can be exactly the same, but the fourth one has to be different. A metaphor I like to use is to say that, let's say if you looked at everyone who lives in one particular state, maybe it's Pennsylvania, and you said, okay, what city do you live in? And you get a couple different answers, and you say, okay, what is your street address? Your street. What street do you live on? And you get a couple different answers. And you say, what's your house number? And you get some different answers. Well, let's say you have two people that live on the same street. So they'll live in the same state. That's the first quantum number. They'll live in the same city. That's the second quantum number. They'll live on the same street. That's the third quantum number. But to exist as two unique people, let's say, they have to have the fourth quantum number different. In that case, they live in a different house. So it's the same thing with electrons, okay? They can have three of the same piece of information, but the last one, which is magnetic spin state, has to be unique. So in an atom, the energy states couple together through spin-orbit interactions, and they form energy levels commonly discussed in intro chem courses. And when atoms are brought together in a bulk material, though, things start to change. If we look on the left, you see atoms in discrete energy levels, okay? And here's a nice little picture. It looks like a Bohr model of the atom, where you have the nucleus in the center and different kind of orbitals or energy levels with electrons spinning around it. It looks like a planetary model. And it's not a bad way to envision this type of system. As more electrons are added to the atomic system, they're added further away from the nucleus, and they have higher energies. But if you try to take one of these atoms and you put 100 atoms around it and then 100 more, and eventually you have billions of atoms all next to each other with all their electrons kind of intermingling, you end up with something different where the energy states kind of overlap and they form continuous bands of states. Or in semiconductors and insulators, they form nearly continuous bands that are actually separated by a distinct energy gap. So instead of all these different orbital energy levels like a solar system, it's kind of like in semiconductors you end up with only two levels, okay? There's a lower energy level, which is known as the valence band. There's a higher energy level, which is known as the conduction band. And there's this energy gap or band gap in the middle. And if you're an electron hanging out in the valence band, you have to be promoted, you have to be excited to get up to that higher energy state, which is called the conduction band. And only once promoted can you actually take part in electrical conduction. So, in semiconductors and insulators, the valence band is the lower energy level, and that corresponds to the ground state. Also, the conduction band corresponds to the excited state, where the electrons are free to move about in the material, and they can participate in conduction and kind of behave just as conductive electrons in a metal. But in order for conduction to take place in a semiconductor, electrons must be excited out of the valence band, go across the band gap, and into the conduction band. And this process is called carrier generation. Okay? And if you look at the little drawing below, you see EV, that's valence energy. You see EC, that's conduction energy or conduction band, and then the band gap. Notice that when an electron is promoted or excited into the conductive band, now it's up there, and what's left behind? Well, we call that a hole. So conduction takes place due to empty states in a valence band, which are the holes, and also due to having electrons in the conduction band. So both holes in the valence band and electrons in the conduction band contribute to conduction in a semiconductor. Okay, now, if you can think ahead a little bit, what does this have to do with semiconductor nanoparticles or quantum dots? Well, ask yourself, what might excite these electrons? And what might cause this carrier generation? What type of energy could possibly hit a semiconductor and get an electron to be excited up to the conduction band? Well, we already talked about optical properties and how they change, so that would be a great guess, okay? We're going to talk about light. Photons are going to be the ones that are going to provide the energy for this excitation. So, in semiconductors and insulators, a photon with an energy equal to the band gap energy will be emitted when an electron in the conduction band recombines with a hole in the valence band. So in that first bullet, what we're assuming is, okay, an electron has already been excited to the conduction band. But when it falls back down to the valence band and recombines with a hole, it will give off a photon of light with an energy equal to the band gap. And the electronic band structure of a semiconductor, therefore, will dictate its optical properties. What color will it give off? Well, it'll give off the color of a photon whose wavelength is proportional to the energy of the band gap. Let me say that again. What color will a semiconductor give off when an electron recombines with a hole by falling from the conduction band to the valence band? It will give off the color of light. Okay? It will give off the color of the photon whose wavelength is proportional to the energy of the band gap of that semiconductor. I know that's a mouthful. So again, the band structure of a semiconductor dictates its optical properties. By the way, how much energy would it take to promote the electron up to the valence band? It would take the energy of the band gap or more. If we look at the third bullet, we see gallium phosphide. This is a material commonly used for green LEDs, and it has a band gap of 2.26 electron volts. That's the intrinsic band gap. So carrier recombination across that gap will result in emission of 550 nanometer light, and we can see 550 nanometer light. It looks green to us, so that's why we use gallium phosphide if we want to make a green LED, okay? That's a light-emitting diode. It wouldn't really make sense to use a semiconductor material which gave off light upon recombination that was not visible, okay, by our eyes. Well, at least it wouldn't make sense if we were trying to use it for some type of TV or computer display or other type of colored light. So the energy level spacing and quantum confinement. We talked already a little bit about bulk materials and how they form energy bands. Now, if you look at the bottom, skip all the words and just look at the bottom, what we're showing here is that as you go from the bulk material to the nanomaterial, now you have the bands kind of squeezed more tightly and therefore an even larger band gap. So what's happening is, as there's a reduction in the number of atoms in the material, it results in a confinement of the normally delocalized energy states. So those bands are kind of spread out, delocalized energy states. But as the particles get smaller, they get confined, and the band gap increases as a consequence. The electron hole pairs become spatially confined, and this occurs when the dimensions of a nanoparticle approach a very small size, which is right around the de Broglie wavelength of the electrons themselves, the electrons in the conduction band. And as a result, the spacing between energy bands is increased. This is similar to a particle in a box kind of quantum model, and this is discussed in introductory quantum mechanics courses. But all we really need to know, the take-home message is, when you go from bulk to nano, there's a confinement of delocalized states, and therefore an increase in band gap. So semiconductor nanoparticles that exhibit three-dimensional confinement in their electronic band structure are called quantum dots. So now we know. Why quantum dots? Because they experience kind of quantum confinement, and it has to do with a quantum mechanical understanding of what's happening to these electrons. What does all this mean? It means just this. Quantum dots or semiconductor nanoparticles are band gap tunable. So we can change our optical properties by controlling their size. Why? Because if we change their size, we change how we confine their electronic states, therefore we change their band gaps. For this reason, quantum dots are highly desirable for biological tagging. So, energy level spacing and quantum confinement. As a semiconductor particle size is reduced, the band gap is increased. Absorbance and luminescence spectra are blue shifted with decreasing particle size. What does that mean? If you've ever wondered what red shifted or blue shifted means, let's think and talk about that right now. If we look down at the bottom, we see different sized quantum dots. There's big ones over on the right and smaller ones on the left. The smaller they are, that one on the far left, the more confinement there is, therefore a higher energy band, and therefore higher energy photons are given off. And higher energy photons tend to be on the, you know, the upper end of the electromagnetic spectrum. Okay? And so what we mean by blue shifted is higher energy or smaller wavelength. So if you remember the colors of the rainbow, it's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. As you go towards the blue, you're getting higher energy. So this green is smaller, more confined, larger band gap, higher energy. And the larger one would be red shifted. Okay? So again, absorbance and luminescence spectra are blue shifted with decreasing particle size, or red shifted with increasing particle size. So how do you change the color? Just change the size, because that changes the band gap. Or you could use what? A different semiconductor material, because different semiconductor elements or even semiconductor compounds are going to have different band gaps. So use a different material or use a different size of the same material. Here's absorption spectra of cadmium selenide quantum dots. One is a 20 nanometer quantum dot, one is a 40 nanometer quantum dot. Okay, now let's talk about electrical properties. So when thinking about electrical properties, we want to just discuss what is the effect of structure on conduction. First of all, if nanostructures have fewer defects, so, you know, think about the structural magic number and so on, then one would expect increased conductivity versus the macro scale. Okay? And this is, in fact, the case. If you think of something like carbon nanotubes, which may be 1 nanometer in diameter, and just so you can visualize it, a carbon nanotube looks kind of like a, if you took a, maybe a square of chicken wire and wrapped it up into a loop. That would be a carbon nanotube, where kind of each junction, is made up of a carbon, and, each carbon is covalently bonded to 4 other carbons. Another way to think about it is just taking a graphene sheet, which is made up of carbon atoms, and rolling that up into a tube. Well, anyway, it turns out that carbon nanotubes have crazy, unique electrical properties, and actually the resistance is ridiculously low on carbon nanotubes. They're almost lossless as far as their conduction properties go. So other electrical effects on the nanoscale include surface scattering, changes in electronic structure, changes in ballistic conduction and discrete charging, tunneling conduction, and also microstructural effects. So surface scattering, let's think about what that entails. So first of all, electrons have a mean free path in solid state materials. This can be thought of as a distance between scattering events as the charge carriers, electrons or holes, move through a material. In metals, the mean free path is on the order of tens of nanometers. Well, if the dimensions of a nanostructure are smaller than the mean free path, then now we're going to see surface scattering. So what we're seeing here is, just as size contributed to optical properties, the size again is contributing to electrical properties, because it's so small that the structure itself is smaller than kind of the random walk mean free path that the electrons are used to taking. So this becomes, this begins to cause surface scattering. Here are a few pictures to show this. There are two types of surface scattering, elastic and inelastic. Elastic scattering does not actually affect conductivity, but inelastic scattering actually decreases conductivity and can do so significantly. So on the left, we see a bulk or macroscale material where the mean free path is much smaller than the diameter of the material. Then we have like a nanowire, some nanostructure, where the mean free path is actually larger than the diameter of the material. So these materials would have to be, you know, less than, let's say, 50, 40, or 30 nanometers. And now we can see elastic and or inelastic scattering effects. And finally, to wrap up this discussion, we will just touch briefly on possible health concerns of nanoparticles. So, potential health concerns. Is this a cause for concern? What are the dangers of working and using and researching with nanoparticles? Well, nanoparticles are very similar in size to many biological structures and therefore are easily absorbed by the body. So yes, this can be something to think about. This can be a concern, because these things can readily be absorbed into our bodies and interact with different chemicals, you know, proteins, DNA, and things of that nature. Also, nanoparticles, because of their size, will remain suspended in the environment for extended periods of time, behaving somewhat like a gas. The health impacts of nanoparticles are expected to be dependent on composition and structure. So also something to note is, it's difficult to have long-term health risks or to understand the long-term health effects of something that we've only been working with for, you know, say a decade. So, you know, it's still up for debate. There is a lot of research being done right now. investigating different health issues and possible risks of working with nanoparticles. But we would like to think it's still worthy of investigation and can bring a lot to our society. The potential health concerns of nanomaterials are still largely unknown, but again, the EPA has started the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which is providing funding to further investigate this issue. So that wraps up this lecture. Thank you for your time.